Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Leadership Enigma. Now, when we talk about all things leadership, we're also talking about the ability to communicate. Now, this is a subject dear to my heart. As a trained barrister, that was always something that I had to focus on. We were trained to transmit, perhaps not receive very well, but certainly to transmit. So what actually is the language of leadership? Like all of my episodes, I have to find someone far wiser than me. And I've hunted this person down, and he is indeed in the studio. So you're going to meet Simon Lancaster, who first became a speechwriter in the late 1990s, working for Tony Blair's cabinet. I think there's an episode in that one alone. And he's since written speeches for many CEOs of some of the biggest companies all over the world, because he is someone who understands the importance and the, what can I call it, the equation, perhaps, for the language of leadership. Come back to me just after this break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to the Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper, into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. So it's a massive warm welcome to Simon. Simon Lancaster, how are you?
I'm good, feeling really good.
Now I want to talk about your excitement when you walked into the studio. Let's deal with that first, shall we? What did you think?
Just amazing. This is so impressive. It's so professional. I mean, I've done a few podcasts before, and I'll be honest, normally you're kind of doing it in the back of a car or something like that. And
it sounds seedy already, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, absolutely. Whereas this, we've lifted up a level, I think.
And I'm asking you that because I know, because I watched, that you actually did a TED video on the language of leadership, which has had many, many millions of views, Can I dare say, so, which is why I asked you, because first impressions last, don't they, from a language point of view. But also, as you walked into the studio, I was intrigued as to the impact on you.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your background, because you didn't, I suppose, immediately become a speechwriter, but what tell us a little about the journey to becoming a speechwriter for Tony Blair's cabinet initially.
Yeah, well, my journey started actually in a completely different direction.
I love a story.
My first ever job after leaving school was playing piano.
Right.
In a restaurant off Leicester Square, a French restaurant called Chez Solange.
Okay.
And my dream was actually to become a songwriter. So ever since the age of probably about 11, I was writing like a song a week, and I thought they were brilliant, and I'm going to be the next Lennon, McCartney, Jagger, Richard, whatever. And I was sending my songs out left, right and centre, and thinking, this is amazing, it's going to completely take over the charts. And the feedback was always the same. It was, like that. And so then I disappeared into the civil service, and I became a civil servant, joined at the very bottom rank, then worked my way up, and I became a minister's private secretary when I was probably about 24 or 25 or something.
Wow,
like
young.
That. Yeah, so that with it's a fast stream post. So this is like the Bernard Woolley job in Yes Minister. And it was...
I love that program.
Oh my God. Do you know what? It taught me so much about politics. I still swear there's no better education than anyone can have it in British politics and civil service, government.
We don't make them like we used to.
We really, really don't. And it was a classic BBC one about educate, entertain and inform.
Right.
So bang on the money. But I don't know whether you know the story behind it, actually.
No.
But so Jonathan Lynn, who was one of the writers of it, and Anthony Jay, they used to have lunches with Harold Wilson's top team. So was it Marsha Faulkner, his political secretary, and Joe Haines, who is his press secretary? And they used to just spill all of the dirt on what was going on.
No wonder it was so good then.
Yeah. I mean, it's truth. It's
from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, from the horse's mouth. Yeah.
We've actually used clips of that to train advocates,
yes,
especially in relation to cross examination and exam. There's a piece there we call Boiling the Frog, and it's just a phenomenal bit of media. But again, it was so true, so accurate, and Yeah, they don't make them like they. We're reminiscing, aren't we, Simon? But yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. I tell we understand this, because just before we went into recording mode, you said, how did you go from being a barrister to a police officer? How did you go from songwriting to the civil service?
It was a job.
Right.
To start
opportunity
off with.
Knocked.
It was just a job. But I had loved Yes Minister when I was at school. And so I just made it my mission. I want to get that Bernard Woolley job. I want to be working in private office.
Right.
And when I got it, I had the dream pairing. So I was paired up with Alan Johnson.
Right.
That I'm sure some of your viewers will know. For those who don't, he's the most incredible politician. He was had a really tough start in life. He was orphaned when he was 12.
Right.
Left school with no GCSEs. His first job was stacking shelves in Tesco.
Right.
And I remember the very first time I took him out to deliver a speech, and I'd prepared his speech for him, which is what you do as a private secretary, and you kind of put all the bits together. I was very proud of this. I thought it sounded really intelligent,
yeah,
and all of this. And literally, I gave it to him on the train as he was going up. The speech was in Harrogate, and he was going through it, and he was like, fucking hell, this is bullshit. This is rubbish.
That's called feedback, Simon.
Yeah, who wrote this crap? And I was like, I did. And he was like, right, I'm doing it again. And I'm 25, 26. He's winging it. He's a new minister. He's winging it. And I'm like, anything could happen here. There's journalists here. I could see my career slipping away. And I can still to this day remember how he began, that he just, so this was to the Trade Unions Congress, his speech was, and he started off like, Stalin, Mussolini, Hitler, three of the most wicked dictators in the history of humanity, and they all did exactly the same thing on their march to power. They banned trade unions. Why did they ban trade unions? Because they knew trade unions were an essential part of a successful democracy. And it was like, boom, you know, none of this, I'm delighted to be here and thank you so much to so-and-so for inviting me. It was like straight away, he just grabbed the audience by the neck. And then he spoke for maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes or something like that. And it was stories, just stories. It was a mix of personal stories about his own experiences, right, as a postman, like, and getting paternity leave and the way the union fought for more pay. But it was, he then mixed his personal story with the national story about what Thatcher had done to the trade unions in the 80s and the miners' strike and all of this. And I was just watching at the back of the room with wonder as this guy who literally left school, no O-levels whatsoever,
yeah,
how he was able to command such respect from some of the most educated people in the planet. You know, you've got the whole of the political press there and all of this. And I learned two things from that. Firstly, anyone can do this. You don't need to be a posh Etonian idiot to be a great speaker. Anyone can learn this skill. But the other thing that I learned, which is really, really important, that's this thing about the speechwriter as a puppeteer, which you get in like the thick of it in West Wing and Yes Minister, is a myth. It's a myth. You're not stuffing words in people's mouth. A good speechwriter instead has to find what's inside someone's soul.
And their personal style.
Yeah, their personal style, but also their personal stories.
Mm.
So that you're an efficiency saving, you know, and you've got to be more of an impressionist than you have a puppeteer. That's really the secret of success as a speechwriter.
I've got two burning questions, Simon, and these are they. One of them is, as you listened in awe to that speech, did you see any seeds of what you had originally written, or had that all gone?
There were little bits, but the focus of the speech as drafted was all of the things that the government was doing at that time. The government had a huge agenda when it came to employment relations, industrial relations. So it was like, we've introduced this directive and this regulation, and we've done that. And that stuff was there, but it was tucked away right at the back.
Okay.
And so this is still a shift that you see occurring, that every corporate leader who goes out there wants to brag about what they're doing. You know, they want to give a long list of everything that's going on.
Mm.
And the audience doesn't give a shit, frankly. So frame it. So what you do is...
We're telling it like it is
today.
Yeah,
I mean, you might as well, right? But, you know, so you start the speech, 80% is about what's going on in the world out there at the moment, how you feel about this as a person, why you care about it. You're telling stories. And then the very last bit is, and you know, at my company, insert, you know, we're doing this, that, and the other. But just put that so it's more like in proportion with what the audience thinks about it.
Here's my other burning question. As you, again, were watching this initial, which obviously had a huge impact on you.
Yeah.
Did you ever ask him where that came from within himself? Because as you say, he wasn't an academic, but this ability, where did it come from?
Just I did ask him, and I learned so much from him.
Yep.
He was a great reader. So right. Always on the train, he would always have a few books on the go, as would I. He was an autodidact, as am I. And there's this lovely line from one of the greatest ever speechwriters, Peggy Noonan, who right. was Ronald Reagan's speechwriter, who advised Aaron Sorkin on The West Wing, where she said, reading is collecting wisdom, writing is spending it.
Wow.
And I love that. I absolutely love it. So it's what you put in, then comes out, and I still do it. I mean, to a full, you know, I drive my wife up the wall. I have piles of books, you know, literally 20 books by the bed. I'm reading them all at once, you know, and on my desk and on the kitchen table and by the telly as well. So constantly reading. But he'd watched and he'd learned.
So he's consuming all the time, and then that was almost part and parcel of how he was able then to do what he did.
Yeah, but I think also that, like growing up in the trade union culture,
yes.
you know, to become first a branch rep and then you work your way up, you need to have a way with words. You need to know how to win people over. So this is why in the Labour Party,
well.
Yeah, they've always recruited from either the trade unions or teachers
right.
who are also good at, who know how to stand up in front of people. Whereas the Tories have always recruited like barristers or business people, you
yeah.
know, so that's been their main recruiting ground. And I think one of the reasons Parliament is not as good as it has been right now is because they've stopped recruiting from those
yeah.
places. And instead it's ex-special advisors or people who have worked in think tanks who are getting safe seats. And as a result, I think you that's why we've got a shadow cabinet and a cabinet, which are not very good at speaking at the moment.
It's interesting you say that, because obviously I became a barrister in the early 1990s, and I do remember a number of my peers said that they were asked the question about whether life at the bar was actually a stepping stone into politics for them. So
yeah.
interesting you talk about that connect. So you're giving us a little bit of a clue in relation to how you then ended up in the late 1990s working for Tony Blair's cabinet.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how that came about and what was that role about?
Yeah. So I spent a couple of years as Alan Johnson's private secretary. And while I was doing that, you get to know some other ministers. And
you're in the corridors of power.
Well, ish. I mean, you know, on the 8th floor of 1 Victoria Street, where there were some, you know, great people around. You know, we had Lord Sainsbury had his office just a couple of doors down from us. And I mean, you know, he was always an amusing figure, actually. He always seems to have the weight of the world on his shoulders. You'd see him just walking down to go to the loo, and he always looks. And I was like, God, if I had $4 billion in the bank, I think I'd have a bit more of a spring in my step. If there was any man who proved that money doesn't bring you happiness, it was he. But because I got to know other ministers, I started like occasionally scripting lines for them. And I remember that Patricia Hewitt, who was then Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, was making some speeches about Britain's place in the European Union and, you know, about
right.
the euro, the single currency. This is a while ago now. And I remember giving her a couple of lines that were rhetorical contrasts. And God, what was the line that I gave her? I gave her a line which was about economic will must not be trumped by a political will not. And it was a nice, just a simple...
Like sound bites.
Yeah. And I remember, actually, doesn't everything come around in a loop? That the thing that had inspired me to give her that line was a line from Yes Minister.
Oh, what?
Which was brilliant. A line that I think Sir Humphrey came out with about political will and an administrative will not, which was the whole relationship between the two. And she likes that line. She said, who came up with it? And it's like, you know... And then she had a vacancy on her team and she got me in as a full-time speechwriter. So I wrote for her for 4 years.
Right.
Then Alan got appointed to the cabinet and I worked for him over, I think, 3 different departments. And that was it. So I ended up being a full-time speechwriter in Whitehall, I think for like about 8 years,
wow.
7 or 8 years or something like that, and did a few departments. and loved it. And you really...
You did love it.
I absolutely loved it. But you really learn your craft doing it in Whitehall because secretaries of state, you're Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, you're given maybe 4 speeches a week. So I was literally banging out like 10,000 words a week. It was phenomenally high paced.
And you also know that they're going to be pulled apart.
Yeah.
By the opposition, by the media.
Yeah,
by,
damn right.
So anything said, well, you know, we know what it's like, don't we? That they actually say, well, hang on, let me just play back what you said 6 months ago. So there is a big level of critique to it.
Damn right. So, I remember when Alan was education secretary and I wrote a speech for him lamenting the decline in school standards.
Yeah.
I had a comma in the wrong place or I'd missed an apostrophe or something like that. And Marianne Seagartz, who I think at the time was assistant editor on The Times, did a whole thing, whole article in The Times, basically ripping it out of the grammar in my speech about decline in standards. So after this, like literally, I went into my room the day after and I think 3 different people had left copies of, you know, the book Eats, Shoots and Leaves.
Yes. What was your funniest memory from the days of speech writing? I mean, you know, the child in me thinks you didn't slip in the word xylophone or rhinoceros into a speech, did you? I just thought that will get them. But it may not be as childish as that. But was there a funny moment that stands out for you?
We did play games.
Oh, did you?
We did play games. And so there were some speeches where you'd try and make sure that the first letter of words would spell something rude or something amusing. So that was a frequent speechwriter game. But Alan was always great fun to write for anyway. And so we'd often play with Beatles songs because he was a huge Beatles fan. And part of the reason I got on so well with Alan was we'd often sit and we'd chat about our favourite album, our favourite song on this album. Yeah. And, you know, this was a continuing conversation. It still is a continuing conversation that I have with him. And so we used to play with that in speeches. So I remember when he was trade secretary and the Doha trade round was dragging on, we did a speech called The Long and Winding Trade Round. And then when he was at education, he was speaking about school councils, we did a speech which was Power to the Pupils. And I think we then did a speech that was Sergeant Pepper Economics. And so there was a constant like...
You were having some fun along the way.
Yeah, how can we get Beatles songs into speeches?
What do you think was the most iconic or important speech that you were ever involved in? Where you thought, this has really made a difference. This is high stakes. I mean, much of it is high stakes because of the sheer context you're operating in. But is there one that stands out where you think we made a real difference there?
Oh, God, there were tons. I mean, politics is fundamentally about making a difference. And I mean, I don't know why, just instantly when you said that, I think the speech that instantly comes to my mind is the one we did launch in a green paper about children in care.
Right.
When he was education secretary. And this was the time when there was all that awful stuff going on with Baby P. You know, the Baby P story. And you just, you know, always in politics, you see the link between real people's lives and what you're doing. And I think that was all very moving, you know, and Alan cared about that deeply because he had been saved from going into care by a very generous social worker when he was 12 years old. And so all of that stuff really, really mattered. But you start getting into the stories of people who have been in care in this country and they're awful experiences in some cases. And that really mattered. And it was just like some of the little things that we did. And I remember... Like we had this policy, which I think may have come directly from Alan himself, which was just about creating an allowance so that every kid in care in the country could buy their own musical instrument. And I just, you know, me and Alan had both grown up here with music being the love of our lives. I grew up poor as well, you know, council flat, mum, single mum on benefits.
Yes.
And for me, playing keyboards was everything. It was my route into the world, actually, that sort of thing.
Who taught you? I'm just intrigued. Did you?
I taught myself to start off with. Okay. And then I got like a kind of bursary paid for me to have piano lessons. And I made it to like I was grade 8 within a couple of years of my first formal lesson. But I pretty much taught myself. And Alan the same with the guitar as well. And so this, I think that It's a really tiny policy.
Well, it's all connection, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which we'll come on to.
But in the scheme of government expenditure as well, I think the whole policy costs like something like, I think it was 5-8 million or something like that, which within the context of like a £60 billion education budget is really not a lot of money. But God, the difference to these people's lives.
As you're explaining this to me, Simon, I can imagine that actually there's has to be a high level of connection and trust between you and the person you're writing the speech for.
Yeah.
Because in many ways, you're one voice.
Yes.
Is that something that you have to really work at? Or is there a chemistry piece to it where you found you can write for some people and you can't write for other people? You're just not the right connection. Did you ever find that?
I have. Do you know what? I've literally only found that once.
Okay.
And in that case, I just had a one-to-one with the principal who was looking for a speechwriter. And I came out, and I'll be honest, I felt I'd been left cold.
Right.
And, you know, I really felt no connection whatsoever. I don't know what
it
was.
It must happen. We're talking about human beings, aren't we?
I know, literally only one. Most people I can find some common ground with, I can relax with, have a laugh with, share some stories with. And this person, absolutely not. And so I just sent an email after that saying, I just politely said, I've got a bit too much on at the moment, actually.
I
didn't say, I think you're made of ice.
I'm not even going to ask who. Now, listen, you've gone on to now do incredible seminars, your TED Talk, over 4 million people have watched that. You're writing speeches for some of the big CEOs. Was that a natural transition for you to move from the political sphere into the corporate sphere? How did that happen?
It happened very naturally. My kind of fire for writing political speeches left when Gordon Brown became Prime Minister.
Okay.
You know, and I was writing speeches for Allen then. We were at the Department of Health. And I just literally, I despaired at the whole thing. It was just so messy. You know, there was no lack of direction, even trying to write speeches about you know, the future of the health service. I was left
alone. So you thought, time to transition.
Time to transition. And literally, yep. I made two investments. One of them was, you know, putting in place, create a speechwriting agency. And literally, the other investment was I went down the bookies and put money on David Cameron to become the next Prime Minister at 5-2. And I made those two investments at once. And both really paid off. People had been approaching me anyway, asking me to write speeches for them because, you know, when you're in government, people leave and they go into business and they're going to write, you know.
Well, it's hand in glove almost, isn't it?
Yeah, and so people were calling me up and saying, would you help out with this speech to the CEO of this company? And I was like, and I remember checking the rules once or twice and thinking, oh, I can probably freelance actually if I get permission. So I had a good line manager in the civil service, who said, yeah, I don't mind you freelancing for this person.
Right.
And so I did two freelance gigs while I was still within Whitehall. And I loved it. And the clients loved it. And as I was looking at the market, it struck me as bizarre that at that point, speech writing was just not professionalised in the UK. You know, there was very few training courses were given about speech writing. There were very few people who were full-time speech writers, and the only people that were really based within Whitehall. And I thought there's such a gap in the market here. Yeah. There's all sorts of people doing social media advice, even back then, and, you know, guerrilla marketing and all sorts of, like, the most specific niche areas of marketing. No professional speechwriters. So I just thought there's a gap in the market here. I set up the company and I had in place all of these ideas about, oh, I'm going to have an advert in The Economist or something like that. Didn't need to do any advertising at all.
Word of mouth.
Just straight away word of mouth. And I think within the first year, I'd already written for the CEOs of something like 7 different FTSE 100 companies. And there was just such a gap there, because they were being left on their own with disastrous consequences. You know, I mean, CEO speeches were, you know, at best inept and failing to connect. And at worst, you had kind of like the Gerald Ratner, Tony Hayward's, like, you know, yeah, absolutely, like let the share price implode kind of scenario.
Well, words matter, don't they? And I think, you know, I've always learned that as a barrister in relation to what is said to judge and jury. And trying to be deliberate and thoughtful. And I speak for a living, but I'm very much work in progress. And sometimes I say something or use a phrase, and I think, where's that coming from? Why have I suddenly latched onto something?
Yeah.
So it's interesting what you said in relation to how you consume and then how you transmit, because there must be a link there.
Yeah.
And we're a byproduct, aren't we, of kind of how we're made up. I want to ask you to help anyone who's listening or watching this some top tips, because communication is so big for any leader. You haven't got to be the CEO of a FTSE 100. Yeah. It's still about your ability to communicate with the people that you lead.
Yes.
So where can we go in relation to some top tips so people listening or watching this can think, I can use that. I can use that today.
Yeah.
Or I can put that into play tomorrow. Now, I watched your TED talk, and I know there were six areas that you focused on there.
Yeah.
Should we focus on those, or have you got some thoughts in your mind about? See, we're just free flying with this now,
yeah,
aren't we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well,
work.
I think that there are three big head flips.
Okay.
That most speakers need to make that kind of turn on its head what you might
Let's
have thought about speech
though.
Writing before. So the first one I think is that the audience is more important than the speaker.
Right.
So think not what is it that I want to say, but think instead what is it that the audience is interested in? What do they want to hear about? And then focus your speech around that.
Okay.
So that's the first head flip. The second one is that emotions are more powerful than logic. And this is a simple matter of biological fact. So, you know, if you're trying to make people think differently about some narrow little issue, make sure that you start from either a moral perspective or, you know, an emotional perspective, or with a story, with something that's going to hit their instincts and emotions before you get to the logic. Emotion's
right.
more powerful than logic. And the third thing, less is more, you know? So make your speech just about one thing and one thing only. Don't try and make, if your speech is like 11 techniques to good leadership, people are only going to remember that there are 11 techniques to great leadership.
That's right.
They're not going to remember what it is that they are. So those three head flips for me are the really powerful ones. Audience over speaker, emotions over logic, less equals more.
And is that almost the DNA that you carry with you when you're speech writing now for some of the most iconic CEOs?
Yes.
Is that's the essence of what you're trying to achieve?
Well, they're the principles that I put in place. Then there's kind of like there's a process that I will work through, and lots of practical techniques as well.
Why is it, do you think, so few leaders really get the help that they do need when the stakes are so high when it comes to this kind of thing? What's stopping people, do you think, from reaching out and then creating, as you say, at best, fairly bland and inept messaging?
Yeah, I mean, time.
You
know,
time.
For most people, that I think a good speech really does have to be carefully considered. And that, like, who is the audience? Why are they here? What do they really care about? What is your point of connection with the audience? What are you looking to achieve here? And I think a lot of the time people don't have time to pause and properly think about that. But this is the advantage of getting a professional speechwriter in, that I can, if you give me like 30, 40 minutes with a principal where I can just chat to them, ask them some very good questions. I know the questions to ask to get them in the right place.
Yes.
Then I can do them a really good like 15-minute speech out of that conversation just by, you know, use of various, like some of the principles that I've talked about, but also some of the structures. There are templates that you can use for speech writing which work very well, which take the audience on a particular journey, keep them waiting, and some of the practical techniques.
You reminded me, actually, that we had Mohammed Qureshi, who came onto the show, and he won the Toastmaster of the Year speech when he was doing that in Vegas.
I know that
was about the power of words. And if you get a chance to watch that, it's an excellent piece.
I've watched it.
So you know the one I'm talking about.
Of course I do. Yeah, it's a brilliant speech. And he's a Saudi. Yes, absolutely.
I remember how he started it. He has a cigarette in his mouth. He says absolutely nothing. And he's on the stage in front of thousands of people in Vegas. And he sparks up the lighter. And he just pauses. And he just says, "What?" And immediately, through nothing and one word, he's got 4,000 people almost in the palm of his hand.
Yeah.
It's genius in some ways, because there's a little bit of shock when saying, why? He's not actually going to smoke on the stage, is he?
Yeah, yeah.
And then that is the whole essence of the story that then follows.
Yeah. You can do that in Vegas.
What goes on in Vegas stays in Vegas.
I remember doing a speech once for one business leader who set fire to a load of fake money on stage to make a point in Vegas. And that's kind of fun thing you can do there. I bet you any money that at the Queen Elizabeth Conference Centre in Westminster, say, oh no, health and safety. In Vegas, anything goes.
Who would you love to write a speech for that you haven't yet?
Oh, crikey. What? I mean, there are so many amazing people in the world at the moment.
If you can wave a magic wand. I know this is a ridiculous question.
I'd love to write a speech for Oprah.
Would you?
I'd love to write. Oprah, I think, is my favourite persuasive speaker at the moment. She knows how to connect with people's instincts and emotions really, really deeply. The reason I'd love to write for her is because I'd love to learn from her. Do you know what I mean? I kind of consider that every time that I work for someone, I'm learning something new, actually.
Well, it's got to be a two-way process. Oprah, if you're watching or listening,
get in touch. Give me a shout.
Simon's willing to join forces for you. Wouldn't that be funny?
Yeah.
That would be a first.
And I'll offer you 20% off, Oprah. There you go. There's a deal.
You can't really say fair than that. You heard it here first. What's the aspiration then for you? What's the direction of travel for you now? From your growth and your development and you still seeking fresh and new opportunities. What's next for Simon Lancaster?
I genuinely love doing what I do. And so like within the last week, there are three separate people that I've written speeches for, all of whom are people where the stakes are high.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And they've got something really, really important to say. They're all people that I really like. They're all people that I really, really want to do well. And this, I would be really, really happy doing this until the day I pop my clogs. I literally would. And the only thing that I fear is actually that there'll be a time when I'm not able to do this because I love doing it
You're
so
really
much.
You're passionate about it.
I love doing it.
Is this your purpose, Simon? Do you think you're living your purpose?
Totally. Yeah. I love doing what I do. You know, there's not, some people love doing Sudokus, they love doing crosswords. Me, I love nothing more than the puzzle of sitting down with someone and they want to achieve this effect with this audience. And we're then like, right, how do we do it? And then you're playing with the words and getting the words, getting the arguments, getting the images, getting the stories, putting everything in the right order in order to achieve the effect that you want with the audience. And I absolutely love this. I think if there was one thing where I would love to push further, it is about making sure that more and more kids are taught this at school. Because I do think that everyone needs these kinds of powers, the ability to persuade people, just some knowledge of basic rhetoric. And it delights me, in fact, that I think both of the political parties are now agreed on the need to teach rhetoric more effectively in schools. And I'm delighted that that's happening.
I was going to ask you a question, actually, and this is an interesting segue. I'm doing a talk to some young adults of Leadership Through Sport and Business, which is an amazing social mobility charity, and a big shout out to them. What advice would you have to the young adults? Because you talked about coming from a humble start, and then you took opportunity as it identified itself. But what would kind of be your advice to young adults who may be watching or listening this in relation to fulfilling their dreams and being able to compete at the highest level and not feeling as if they're at a disadvantage, even though maybe they are at a disadvantage, let's be honest, in some ways? What would be your thoughts or your advice?
I would say to them, be proud to be yourself and be proud to show yourself as well to the world. That I think so many people, for so many reasons, are left with the impression that they're not worthy to speak, that they don't have a right to be heard.
Well, they've got nothing to say
in this culture. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think the journey that I went through, I remember when I was in my early 20s, and like because I'd grown up on a council estate, single mum with benefits, all of this stuff, I felt terrified of speaking in these meetings with other civil servants who had been to Oxbridge, you know? And you, literally, I remember sitting there and like, you know, hand shaking, you know, just with fear at speaking. And I think it was actually working with Alan Johnson that inspired me, that really showed me, you know, you can come from a humble background and still speak from a stage like that, and it doesn't matter. And I think a lot of people do what they work it out later on in life as they get a little bit older, but just shortcut it and get in there, you know, right at the beginning and be proud of where you come from. And if you do come from a humble origin, if you are a little bit different or you feel like you're a little bit different, then lean into that point of difference, because everyone feels they're a bit different. Everyone feels like the odd one out. And so as soon as you, everyone feels they've been through hardship. So the more you talk about those things, those areas in your life, the easier people will find it to connect with you.
Sounds like you had a good mentor in Alan.
Yeah.
At an early age.
Yeah.
And that did a lot for you. It's just from how you describe him and some of the stories that you're telling.
Yeah.
It seems like he had a significant impact on you in a wholly positive way.
Absolutely. And I've said that to him as well. He's been hugely inspirational and important to me, yeah.
Now, you've got a book in front of you.
Yes.
Connect.
Yes, indeed.
Hold that up and the cameras can get that. And it says, how to inspire, influence and energize, connect anyone, anywhere, anytime.
Indeed.
Almost, I feels like that could be a drinks advert, couldn't it? Anytime, any place, anywhere.
Indeed.
So tell me a little bit about Connect.
Yeah. So, Connect is a book that I've written very much actually with a general audience in mind. So I've written a few books before, but they've been either for specialist speech writers.
Okay.
Whereas this is actually for anyone who just wants to be better. And my starting point in the book is that we think through connections. When we meet someone for the first time, we meet them and we look at them and we're like, oh, you remind me of this person. Or when we're introduced to a new issue, we look at the issue and we're like, this issue is like that issue. And we think through analogy, we think through metaphor. And so this is fundamental to the way the brain works. And I'm not talking metaphorical connections, literal neural connections.
Right.
And so the starting point in this book is that it is forming those connections that makes good communicators great. So it's either about communicating through analogy or through metaphor. Just let me give you an example, which is relevant to like business leaders, like the launch of ChatGPT, right? This, I mean, in some ways, the launch of ChatGPT has been one of the most successful commercial launches in history, right? But in terms of communication, God, could it have been done better?
Right.
Do you know? Because now you've got all literally like dozens and dozens of headlines talking about how chatbots are going to lead to the end of humanity.
The end of the world is
nigh. You see, with ChatGPT, what they've done there is they've introduced it and straight away people are like, GPT, what does GPT even stand for? Do you know what GPT stands for?
I don't.
No. I'm sure most people have not got a clue what it stands for.
We've all heard the term, but I don't know what is GPT? That's a great question.
Right. And this is what so much bad business communication is like. It's incomprehensible acronyms. Whereas, you know, when you're introducing something to people, the way you want to make connections which are positive in people's minds. So why not say, well, ChatGPT, this is going to transform your life in the way that the internet transformed your life, or like the way that, you know, social media, or like the way that when you first picked up a pen, the wonder you felt when you first picked up a pen. And these are like inspiring connections to make. So that's using like analogy, like saying this is like that time, but equally like you could use metaphor with GPT. And this is what Steve Jobs always did when he was launching his products. He would say, this product is basically a person. It's your friend. Like with Macintosh, I'm going to let Macintosh speak for itself. You know, and Macintosh did speak from
almost giving it a personality.
Giving it a personality, making it, you know, like literally talking about it as if it was a person. And so why didn't they call it Chatty Gupta? You know, this is Chatty Gupta. It's the, you could imagine Steve Jobs. If Steve Jobs was launching ChatGPT, he'd have gone on stage and say, Steve Wozniak, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg. I've been lucky enough to work with some of the greatest people in our history, people who were courageous, people who were curious, people who were creative. You know, don't you want a great collaborator, someone by your side at all times? Well, today, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to give you the greatest collaborator you could ever hope for. They'll never get angry with you. They'll never get upset. They'll never get tired. They'll never ask you where the loo is. And they'll never ask it for a pay rise. You know, ladies and gentlemen, introducing to you Chatty Gupta. And then, you know, on comes the picture of Gupta onto the screen, you know, saying hello, you know, or whatever, probably to a soundtrack of the Toy Story song, You've Got a Friend in Me, or something like that. And, you know, so do you see how there I'm using analogy and metaphor in order to just make a shortcut in people's minds, saying this is something you're going to love, you know? Whereas incomprehensible acronym, people just look at it with fear and it's like this sounds sci-fi.
I quite like that. Okay, here's a really cheeky question that sparked my mind. The leadership enigma. Here we are. I think you're going to be episode number 183.
Yeah.
What should we do with the leadership enigma? How do we make this more accessible to the world? Should we give it a personality or what do we do with it?
I think you've already got so much personality in this program. You don't need any advice whatsoever.
We'll take any help from any quarters. How do people get hold of the book?
It's all over the place. So Waterstones, WH Smith.
Amazon as well.
Amazon, indie stores, all over the place, yeah.
And how do people get in touch with you to learn more, get you involved in them, get you in to help with their speech writing? How is that possible?
Simon@bespokespeeches.com. Drop me an email. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter @bespokespeeches. I'm on TikTok even, the speech writer.
You're on
one.
The leadership enigma. Come on, Simon.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've made it. All right. Listen, I just want to say a massive thank you for taking the time to come in. I know we've just really tickled the surface, so I'm going to suggest that you have to come back to us at some point and we'll dig a little deeper, maybe into some of these the pillars that you've mentioned.
I would absolutely
Maybe we even actually get you on and we do a little bit of a live one where we get people to throw questions out to you and then we can answer those live on air as well. So maybe something like that. You up for that?
Of course I am, absolutely.
Always have a challenge. Simon, thanks so much for coming in. You're a star.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Adam.
Cheers.
Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.